This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is Dr. Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 68. And very excited because we're going to, we're doing this in studio this time. I haven't done it in studio in a long time. And I'm very excited because I have Dr. Lorraine Hedke here with me, who is a mentor of mine. And I have the privilege of getting to work with her. And she's my boss. She hates when she's, when I say that, but
true. Yeah.
She is the program chair of the program that I get to teach in. And I know a lot of the listeners are going to know her work anyway already. And so just very excited to have you here. Thank you for coming, Lorraine. And I guess I want to start by maybe just having you share with our listeners a bit of your background and how you came into working from a narrative perspective, so to speak.
Sure. Thanks. It's really nice to be here talking with you, too. I don't want to claim boss.
Yeah, I know.
But it's really nice to be with you in the chat. Let me talk a little bit about just my background. Because ironically, I would not say that I came into this work from a narrative perspective originally. That after I got my master's degree, I did a postgraduate training in family therapy that was just starting to explore some of the ideas of social psychology and deconstructionism. Narrative, the term narrative yet hadn't even been brought into my world, and I don't think it was even being used yet in by the Australia, New Zealand people. So I actually came into some of the ideas through some postmodern thinking and some postmodern reading that introduced me into some new ways of kind of deconstructive thinking that eventually, when I found narrative, that those two aligned comfortably for me. So I got my master's degree in medical social work, and then that kind of all fell into place when I started doing the work in deconstructionism and understanding family therapy from that, from a, both the systems perspective and from deconstructionism. And it was probably about a decade after that that I started really investing in, and studying a lot of narrative work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Okay. A lot of your work has been around working creatively with dying, death, grief and loss. And I'm wondering, how did you find yourself working in this realm?
At the same time I was doing that postgraduate study, I was in Phoenix doing that, and I was working in Tucson then, and I'd started working right out of grad school. I started working in hospitals, and I felt at home working there. So I was working in both med-surg, emergency, heart, intensive care, all across the gamut of hospitals. Soon into that, I also was working in psych at that time, in psychiatric hospitals. I started working, the hospice was relatively new to the U.S., and I started working with the Catholic Community Hospital, working with hospice back then, and it just felt like home. So there was this kind of coalescing of my studying about deconstructionism and family therapy and being exposed to working in hospices and hospice settings that all came together to make the perfect storm in my career, mm-hmm. where I was questioning the way things were being done, but I also was feeling really comfortable at being at home with people who are dying or sitting with people who are living with grief. And all of that was like, I was just a young pup social work, and I was loving it. Mm-hmm. At that time, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Your early writing states that you believe when a person dies, a relationship does not die. I'm wondering if you could say more.
Sure. We could speak the rest of our time from that premise. I think it's actually kind of one of those obvious statements that for any of us who have experienced a death, that we know that when somebody dies, that we continue to think about them, we continue to love them, we continue to have them a part of our lives, that the fact that they are physically not here with us does not mean that we stop caring, serving. It also does not mean that they stop occupying a space in our thoughts, right? It means that relationship is continued to be accessible, right? So the physiological act of death does not negate relationship, right? I could actually say that the other way around, where relationship supersedes the corporeal sense of life or death, right? Mm. So that when people die, that the relationship continues to have this vibrancy that is both available for access, available for nurturing, available for editing over the years, so that the relationship can continue to morph and change into different things. So that the physicality of somebody dying does not stop all of that happening, right? Mm.
Great. Also, your work challenges the dominant discourse of grieving that encourages forgetting, getting over, moving on, and that you believe people do not want to be forgotten, nor do those who care about someone who is dying or has died want to forget their loved ones. I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
There's a lot in that question, so I might ask you to repeat it if I go off on a tangent here. Because what I'm thinking about is, let me go back to what I was previously speaking about and tie those two things together. I'm thinking about how when a person dies, that the relationship continues, right? That we have those places where we resist wanting to be squeezed into that place of having those goodbyes, those closures, right? Because those are, I think, are artificial constructions. My belief would be is that modernism has gotten obsessed with a lot of those ideas, right? And thinking about kind of the efficiency around death and the efficiency of psychology in general. And that those have pigeonholed people into very small places when people die, right? That privileges individual thinking over relational thinking, privileges pathology over strength, and omits those experiences that happens where love gets to continue, right? So when we start thinking about the way in which the grief psychology has talked about getting over, moving on, finding closure, all of those kinds of things, it is an attempt of modern psychology to reify the individual as the primary important unit, as opposed to the relational unit.
Right.
And that gets folded then into grief psychology. Now, I know I'm off from where your question was. There's other pieces in there that I think that you were wanting me to speak to.
Well, just about this idea that I'm sure you've sat with people who have experienced someone dying or who has died, and they don't want to forget, but oftentimes they're kind of compelled to forget by traditional grief psychology.
I think they get shamed into acting as if they forget, yeah. Right? And so what ends up happening is that people stop speaking about their loved ones, which is a shame, right? Mm-hmm. There's a relational resource that gets lost there, mm-hmm. right? If we're talking about relationships that were troubled and very difficult, there is opportunity to refashion a relationship in a storied form after somebody dies in a narrative way of thinking. And when we're practicing from the position of you have to move on, you have to forget, those opportunities are frozen in time, right?
Closed down.
And they're closed down, right? There's no place for somebody to go where that relationship becomes an ongoing resource, even in the most difficult of relationships. So I think people are shamed and forced into forgetting, right? I think grief psychology has done that ad nauseum, to say you have to complete these tasks, you have to complete these stages, and at the end of it, you have to forget. Mm-hmm. And you need to do it really pretty efficiently, you know, like depending on which DSM episode you want to look at depends on how fast you're supposed to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But the assumption has been that you do it efficiently and you do it quickly. Capitalism gets involved, interwoven in that, in saying that you have to forget, you have to move on, you have to have, you know, a really good funeral so you can say your goodbyes. And while that is useful for some people, right, mm-hmm. the majority of people, it's not. And I actually think that for the majority of people, that actually creates and produces harm, right? Because then let's imagine that same person, they've been forced into this artificial construction that says you have to say goodbye when somebody dies, and you have to forget them to move on. And you have to do that within a month's time, for example, right? No small task, right? But that's not unusual in terms of the kinds of things that people speak to. That then 2 months down the road, 3 months down the road, 2 years down the road, 10 years down the road, that bereaved person feels sad at a memory, right? They, one, don't have the opportunity to share it with anybody. And if they do, they're going to be pathologized that they haven't grieved successfully. And that the only place that they can then take those ideas is into an internalized discourse that they somehow have failed, right? That they have been bad grievers. On top of all this other crap that's going on in their life, they have failed at being a good griever. Right. They didn't do their tasks properly or their stages properly, and they basically are terrible human beings, right? So that gets laid at the foot of people in tremendous pain, right? And it silences the relationship too. There's this woman who I talked to years ago, back when I was a young pup social worker. I show up, I'm like her hospice social worker, and she's dying. So I'm there talking to her about her death. And I'm asking her about all the people who's been in her life and the people who've been important to her. And she's ancient, you know? And she tells me, she kind of leans in really quietly and she says to me, she says, "Can I tell you a secret?" Well, of course, that's going to perk my ears, right? Because that's pretty good. You know, of course she can tell me a secret, and I'm curious about this. And so what she tells me is that she's really excited to die. Now, I don't hear that very often, right? But what made it so interesting to me is, why is that a secret, right? So I ask her a little bit about that. She tells me that she can't wait to meet her husband, who's been dead for a long time, right? And she tells me that when she met this guy, they broke the mold, right? That he was like the best guy ever, and he's been dead for years. She cannot wait to see him again, because in her belief that she's going to be reunited with him, right? Now, what makes that particularly poignant and sad is that she has for years held that as a secret. That even in the context of her social worker from hospice, that she's still whispering that she's carrying a flame for this dead dude, right? Right. To me, that's heartbreaking, right? So this is the downstream effect of all of that. The downstream effect that says you have to forget somebody after they've died is that you have to hold that peace in your heart that they have held as so precious in a private lockbox. Right? Where the relationship just stops being viable.
Wow. Powerful story. Okay. So you've also written that narrative therapy and social construction have expanded the field of death, dying, and bereavement. I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Well, certainly social constructionism has kind of been the umbrella that narrative has couched underneath, right, in how we have thought about things. So so let me just hang with the narrative ideas for a little bit, because I think that the places where my work has resonated has been looking at kind of some of the philosophers who have influence the thinking, right? And kind of those relational experiences of thinking, like particularly like around the work that Barbara Meyerhoff did, who is an anthropologist from Southern California, who coined the remembering with the hyphen.
Right.
Michael White picked up on some of her work, really kind of farmed it for therapeutic value and brought it into the narrative world to look at how story continues to be folded in a recursive kind of way into itself again and again and again. The other part to that then for me is that I think that expands and dramatically shifts how we think of identity as not an individual construction. When we think about remembering practice and we think about our identities as being made up as a composite that happens in relationship with other people, Meyerhoff used to talk about, you know, kind of a club of life, you know, an outdated kind of phraseology, but that those configurations are the places that house and hold your stories. That house and hold the places where identity continues to thrive and gets negotiated. And death does not cancel those things out. right?
Right.
So that's been kind of the linchpin into the world of narrative and death and grief, right? Has been in the remembering ideas, right?
Right.
There's other places, there are other domains in social constructionism around death and grief, you know, like you can look at the whole continuing bonds idea, where, you know, people continue to have a sense of connection with somebody after they've died, that comes out of a little bit of a different domain. But the remembering practice idea really has been birthed out of kind of a narrative framework that implicates that relationship continues to be accessible, moldable, and that your stories, one of the liberating pieces for me, mm-hmm. personally, is that there's a sense that I love to think about that when I die, my stories don't die with me, that there are many, many people who hold my stories, mm-hmm. right? And that there are many people who can shape them, who can feed and water them, mm-hmm. So that those stories can become usable to other people. Over time, right? And so that I am not the exclusive holder of that, right? Mm-hmm. And I find that to be a comforting thought, right?
Yeah.
Because it addresses, I mean, all of us sit with these kind of existential questions about what immortality, you know, how are we immortal and crap like that,
yeah.
right?
What happens to us?
What happens to us, right?
Where do I go?
Where do I go, right? And for me, our stories is what outlives all of that.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And so if other people have stories of mine that I can actually bequeath my stories to people actively, right, or I don't have to, right, that they're just there. They live in the ether. They live in that kind of experience where people can take them up, use them in ways that is helpful or not, right? Or they could be dormant for a really long time, right? I tell this story sometimes of my relationship to my mom. After she died, that for many years, in part because I was encouraged to have kind of that moving on and forgetting and all of that thing, because she died when I was young, that it wasn't until I became a mother that I wanted to refashion a relationship with her and to reinvest in a relationship that had a new kind of curiosity, because I became more curious about who she was as a mother. Right.
Mm-hmm.
As I was entering into some new places in my own life of parenthood. And so I was, because her stories didn't die with her, I was able to kind of reconstruct some different pieces to find what was usable. Right.
Mm.
And how could she then become a grandmother? Right?
Awesome.
Which was really important and is really important to my daughter, who's now almost 27, who has a very strong relationship to her grandmother, who, you know, I've told this to many people who I've talked to over the years, that my daughter's story, she would tell you that she knows her grandmother's recipes, she knows her grandmother's songs, she has a sense of her grandmother being one of her primary encouragers in life, that she has a sense that her grandmother is close to her, right? But she actually, my daughter, who was born in 1992, never met my mother, who died in 1978, right? So that has been a construction of story that happens over time through the refashioning and the re-editing and the recursive and reflexive folding in those stories again and again to make them accessible for my daughter,
yeah.
right?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
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 Okay, you've written recently about how grief psychology has let us down.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, how has grief psychology let us down?
Well, I think psychology has let us down, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's a bigger context. I think I have written about specifically about grief psychology, but I think it lives in a larger context, right?
Sure.
I think that context has been that... There has been an obsession around kind of both kind of pathologizing of people, of enfeebling people, of creating a system where people are seen as an individual commodity as opposed to a relational experience.
Mm.
And all of that has been translated then into grief psychology, where grief psychology has superimposed ways in which people should act, think, and feel. And it is a very regimented way. And in spite of all the challenges over the last 20 years, since kind of the first Continuing Bonds book came out in 1996, that the dominant discourse still is the Kubler-Ross model all around the world. The dominant model for bereavement is still William Worden's four tasks, right? And built into all of those steps have always included the insistence that we let go of the relationship. So I think that grief psychology in particular has done a disservice in that they have the thinking that has been supported has not just cut us off from relationship, but has caused us to question our sanity in that process. And the side effect of that has actually produced more pain, more yearning for people, right? So if I'm working with parents whose child has died, and I am saying, look, you know, it's been a year, you've gone through all the major anniversaries, you know, you've been through their birthday, you've been through the anniversary of their death date, you know,
the Christmas,
whatever, Don't you think it's time that you pack their room up, right? That doesn't address that deep sense of yearning for relationship to continue, right? And so that grief psychology then creates this kind of iatrogenic injury by pigeonholing and forcing people into this way of behaving, and then plants the seed of doubt, right? Plants the seed of failure to say that, what I was saying before, you're not doing it right. You're not doing grief well enough, right? So I think there's some horrific ideas around that have been supported in grief psychology, right? And there's been little pockets, little challenges to it, but again, it's the dominant idea, right? That you have rituals of closure, you have rituals of saying goodbye, that you should move on, you have certain time frames that you should do this in. And all of those things produce that experience that actually creates more yearning for relationship. Because it pockets and silences the place where love can live, right? Rather than that place where I'm continuously asking those parents, you know, what would your child want you to do, right? How are you carrying your child with you, right? How is it that your child continues to be informing your decisions and the meaning that you're making, right? That it doesn't give us the grief psychology has not given us opportunity to establish kind of a negotiated new space of meaning, right? That says, I used to know how to connect with my son or my daughter, you know, or that I used to know how to find my child because they were in their room, right? But now that they're dead, I need to find a new roadmap to find them, right? And grief psychology has failed at not allowing for any kind of roadmap to be developed other than the map of say goodbye, find acceptance, and if not, you know, you're obviously living with complicated grief.
Something's up.
Something's up and something's wrong with you.
Great. And you've also recently written and gave a talk on this, that it's important to fail at grief. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
I think it's important to refuse the trappings, right? As best we can, right? Both as counselors, I think it's important that we talk to people about the kinds of messages that they've been receiving, right? That we help them unpack the kind of the discursive influence that is so prominent, right? I think it's really important when I'm failing as a grief counselor, which I do constantly. I celebrate that failure. When I fail as a grief counselor, I need to be asking my clients, you know, what kinds of messages have you been getting that have been helpful about how you should be thinking, acting, or feeling? What kinds of messages have you been getting that have not been helpful, right? What is it that the bereavement cards that you've been getting in the mail have been suggesting about where you should be, right? You know, are you getting those kinds of messages from well-intended family members who are saying, you know, you really need to get rid of that stuff? Family, this woman I was working with, her family was so concerned that she was like still hanging out with her dead dad's stuff. That one day when she was gone, they went in and they packed everything up and took it to the secondhand store. Now they were being loving. Because they were being informed by this powerful discourse that this is the right way to get over this, right?
And they thought they were being helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right? She obviously didn't take it that way, right? And so, to fail at grief or to fail at grief counseling, I need to be asking about what kinds of messages have you been getting, and are they useful or are they not? Would you like to have a different kind of message? So that allows us to start unpacking the discourse right from the beginning to say, what is it that's helpful here, right? Mm-hmm. Right. I think we can fail at grief when we celebrate love, right? When we celebrate relationship, right? That when we have those places where I can speak about how I continue to love my mother, for example. Even in the face, I've talked publicly about this many times, that I had a very complex and complicated relationship with my mom, that even in the face of that, I can still, at 40 years after she has died, continue to say, I love her, and she has a place in my life and a place in my heart, mm-hmm. right? That is creating that space where I'm failing publicly. Right, to refuse that diagnostic limitation that we have to get over a relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Right. It's just an unfathomable idea to think that we have to get over that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
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 Great. And you just mentioned this a bit, and you have shared that grief psychology has been remiss in creating places that are helpful with most loving relationships, let alone how to respond to a complicated relationship. Which is often the case, I think, right? They're always complex and complicated, right? And I wonder if you could say more about responding to complicated relationships in the face of death,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. I actually think it's really funny that we have these special categories for complicated grief,
yeah.
right? Or complicated relationships, because I would say all relationships and all grief is always complicated. It's just life.
Yeah, right, right, right.
So I think some relationships come with kind of proximal ideas about what's useful and what's not, right? And so what I mean by that, Chris, is that some relationships might have a lot more physical and emotional closeness than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some relationships might have some kind of hybrid versions of closeness and distance. When a person dies, regardless of whether that relationship was a really close relationship or one that would be characterized by other people as meaning like, oh, you're so close to them, or one that where a lot of transgressions has taken place, death provides a pause in the relational fabric for us to stop and take stock and to say, where do I want this relationship to live?
Mm.
Okay. Mm. How much closeness do I want this relationship in my life, right? How much distance do I want in my life in this relationship? I think when I'm speaking with people who characterize their relationship with their dead loved one in this way as being something that was difficult or troubled, that sometimes people want more space, right? And that we can create that quite comfortably. Right. Through narrative questioning that we can talk about, creating more distance from somebody. Right. As well as creating more closeness. Right? And that there may be many touch points along for many years where you get to revisit that to say, how close do I want this relationship or how distance do I want this relationship? It puts in with very complicated relationship that oftentimes we'll put the control or the agency to make those shifts at the foot of the person who has often experienced the infraction, right? And that can be incredibly refreshing for somebody. There's a woman who I have talked with who talks about how after her husband was intensely abusive in every possible way you can imagine, and she endured really suffered for years in this relationship, and when he died she felt relief, right, for good reason. And so the place then that I want to nurture is how is it that initially, she would talk about how she felt like his voice was in her ears, like that relief was something that was bad. And so I would talk to her about who would support those ideas of relief for her, who would give her that place and that breath where he didn't have to whisper in her ear, that she could have other people whispering in her ear that what she was doing was righteous for her. Mm-hmm. Right, that the path that she needed to take and the grace that she needed to live with was around creating more distance, and it became kind of that proximal shift where she could move him further and further away in a storied form after he had died, that she did not have that opportunity when she was alive, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it takes some finesse and some artful questions in how we do that. A cautionary note for me there is we cannot not have that person in her life, right? Like just the fact that he's dead, and talking about this woman's husband again, that does give us the opportunity to pause and ask, where do you want these stories to live or these memories to live? But we can't dislocate him completely.
Right.
He will always have been married to her at one point, right? Mm. And so we can't just rid ourselves of that.
Right.
So again, we have to artfully, carefully make meaning out of it.
Right. Yeah, I think that could set people up in particular ways if you try to, like 86 people out of
you can't.
Their lives, right?
Yeah, and I think this is sometimes becomes quite painful, you know, where you'll have people who say, look, I haven't thought about my father for years, and he was so abusive to me, and I haven't thought about him for years, now he's dead, and I find myself thinking about him all the time, and it's really painful again, right? So we've tried to 86 them out, right? And we've tried to cancel their connection to us previously, but we can't. They're still our father, even if he was a horrible person to you. That we still have to somehow find meaning, create insulation around that relationship in a way that produces love. And sometimes what I'm asking about are questions about how did you respond to this, right? And who helped you respond to this in ways that was useful, helpful, loving, right?
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, in your more recent writings, you have spoken of an aesthetic approach to death, grief, and life, and I'm wondering if you could say more.
One of the reasons I think I felt at home when I was working in hospice, I mean, I started working in hospice when I was like 26, 27, right? Which is a funny thing to say, like I felt at home there, right? But like it felt like I'd gone home, one of the reasons why I think I felt that so powerfully was that there was so much beauty that was happening that people didn't see, right? And that kind of conventional idea of grief psychology would omit actually edit out of the story. And so what I would see again and again in those situations was all these incredible opportunities where people would rise to these occasions that you never thought that they could do. Right, so you see this exalted love that happens. You know, there's this one woman who, back then when I was working, this is an example. I'm going to come back to your question.
No,
this is an example of an aesthetic that, in terms of looking at you know what do we want to underscore? Where does our yellow pen want to go? And I always wanted to go to the stories of love, right? Mm-hmm. And so this one woman I was working with was in her 50s, and her parents had already died, and she was dying, and she was there. She had numerous siblings, and she was there. She was the eldest, and all of her siblings were there with her that they'd come from out of town to look after her while she was dying. And two of her brothers were carpenters, and she asked them to build her coffin.
Oh.
And so while she was in the living room in her hospital bed dying, they were in the patio building her coffin. And she would periodically say, I need to see what you're doing, right? Mm. And so they'd come in and they would show her things, or we'd wheel the hospital bed out, right? Because she wanted to know what kind of loving hands was creating this resting place for her, right? Mm. Now that's a story of love that can be developed. Right? About how was it that she entrusted this to her brothers, right? What did it mean to know that she would be there, right? What did it mean for them to offer that gift at this incredibly hard time, right? These are examples where people rise to those occasions that I'm mentioning that are phenomenal.
Right.
Phenomenal. That you don't think that you could do in any other circumstance.
Right.
And at that moment, you do. You just do because of love, right? So when I speak about aesthetic, I think about where are the stories of beauty that are needing to be woven into the relationship, right? That's my preferred way of looking at life, rather than thinking about what are the stories of loss. Well, there is loss, right? I'd rather speak about what are the stories of resilience and strength that are happening in a relational space, not in a necessarily individual space, because right. I don't think that that produces it, but what's happening in between myself and another person at that moment to construct, craft, celebrate this incredible glue.
Yeah.
Right, of this humanness, of this incredible vulnerability that we live with, mm. right, that we get faced with in death, right,
yeah.
like in that story.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay. You have written about using the subjunctive voice in conversations with folks who are grieving. I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Well, the subjunctive tense, verb tense, is where we conjugate verbs so that we're speaking in the world of possibility.
Right.
Okay, so a subjunctive, the subjunctive verbs that I use a lot are it's like might, could, would,
right.
the simple ones, and that's intentional on my part because the dead don't speak,
mm-hmm.
right? Physically,
right.
they don't speak, right? So we have to become their ventriloquist,
right?
right? This is an idea that comes from Victor Turner's work about working with subjunctive voices and Bruner's work, Jerome Bruner, the psychologist who died a couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
That talks about how when you enter into a subjunctive story, Bruner used to talk about this, when you enter into a subjunctive story, it's a much easier story to enter into than hammering us with reality.
Right.
Which to me sounds just nice. Right, so I can try something on for size,
right.
and not necessarily adopt it as my reality.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it's so I think it's so helpful. It creates so much room. You know,
it does.
I don't have to commit to anything. Right?
No, I don't. I don't.
Yeah, right.
No, it's perfect. Right?
Yeah.
If you have commitment issues, hang in subjunctive
yeah,
world. Right.
right?
So I can borrow from those philosophies in terms of looking at talking about people who have died, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can use that experience of. How do the dead continue to speak to us, right? So I can ask somebody who knows them well, what might they say if they were here,
mm-hmm.
right? What advice do you think they would give you,
mm-hmm.
okay? So they can bring their voice into the room in a way that is the entertaining of a possibility,
yeah.
okay? Now, where it gets really beautiful and aesthetic is that we then can weave that subjunctive story or that subjunctive voice into an actual reality. Right, so I can say, you know, what would your loved one hope you would do in this situation? Right, what mm. kinds of things might they guide you with?
Mm.
And that the follow up questions can be is where do those actions want to take you?
Yeah,
right.
Wow. Yeah.
What difference does that make about what they see in you? Right, what kind of identity that they know about who you are? Right,
mm.
and when you live with that identity, living through that dead person's eyes. And how they see you, how does that make your life better, right? So I can play in that subjunctive ethereal world
mm.
and bring it into an actualized world,
mm.
right? To speak about the construction of an identity, right? That is something rich and profound, which I think is really needed, Chris, when somebody dies and my life has been shattered,
mm.
right? That I need those places to stand on. Right, so I need to be enveloped by those voices to say, how do I live with this? Right, you know, can I tell you a story?
Yeah,
about that?
Of
okay.
course.
So there's the story that's in my head is of this young girl who I met whose mom had just died in a hospital, and this little girl, she was about 15,
mm.
and she had been taking care of her mom, right, while her mom was dying. It was just her and her mom, right. And this little girl for a couple of years had been looking after her mom while her mom was suffering and dying from breast cancer. It's a remarkable thing. Right?
Yeah.
Again, people rise to occasions that are profound,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
When we don't enfeeble them with psychology. and so I met this little girl in the emergency room when just after her mother had died, right? And her mother had been her everything for understandable reasons, right? And the nursing staff was getting really anxious, right? That they were in the emergency room and the little girl had been in there crying for a long time. Again, for understandable reasons, sitting next to her dead mother. And so the nursing staff is like, here I am, the social worker. And the nursing staff is like, could you go talk to her? Because we need like to move this on. She needs to go home. She, you know, we need that bed. The background of kind of the hospital industrial complex, And we need that bed because somebody else is going to need it. So I'm sitting with this young one and talking to her. And so I'm talking to her, like I'm sitting, you know, just side by side with her, a few inches away from her. And her dead mother's body is 6 inches in front of us in this hospital bed. Mm. And I'm asking her questions about, you know, tell me about your mom. Right? Bring this woman to life for me. Tell me what you love about her. Tell me about what it is she loves about you, right? So that this little girl, we're using subjunctive language to bring mom's voice and mom's presence and mom's belief of this young one into the room right then, right? Mm-hmm. And then I ask this young one of the question of what would your mother like you to do at this minute, right? What kind of advice would she give you right now? And this young one says, look, my mom would say it's really important I go home right now because the dogs have been inside all day. And my mom loves our dogs. And she's concerned that they haven't been fed in hours and they need to be outside to be able to go to the bathroom. And from that place, from incorporating her mother's voice, right, we're able then to construct a place of action where I can then say, when you do that, when you go home, when you are tending to the dogs, tell me the story of what your mother's going to be proud of, right? Mm. How is it that you are going to take her with you when you leave here, right? It's a really different story. I think I'm way off on a tangent now from your question, but it's a really different place from normally what happens is in that hospital bed is that the social worker or the nurse comes in and says, look, your mom is 6 inches in front of you and she's dead and you need to say goodbye because we need to take her body now, right? That's too painful for anybody, right? And instead what we're doing is we're fashioning where are you going to take her with you when you leave here? Mm-hmm. And how are her words going to inspire every step that you take when you leave here, right? As it should be, right? Because otherwise, you know, we end up being in so much pain, it's impossible, right?
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Okay. You touched on remembering practices, and I think that's a big piece. And I know you've used those practices in the face of death, and I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a summary about those practices, how you might use them. Or
are you talking about when I'm talking with somebody who's dying?
Yeah, or somebody experiencing grief, maybe, or both.
I've been talking about up to this point has been kind of different examples of how I use that with bereaved individuals, right? Like asking them a lot of questions about where would you like that relationship to live,
right?
How close do you want that? I'll ask a lot of audience questions about who's going to support that kind of closeness or distance. I'll ask different questions around ritual, right? Mm. About, you know, what kinds of rituals, you know, private or public, you know, are you engaged in that serve that purpose for you, that bring that person close? There was a woman I was talking to whose son had died, and she also had a living daughter, and she. I was asking about the ways in which that she kept him close as well as her daughter. And she talked about how she had a charm necklace that had a charm that had both a stone for him and a stone for her daughter on it. And that she wore that every day. And when she did, she had that sense of being connected to both of them, right? So I'll inquire about different kinds of rituals. So I think, you know, I'm looking at where the bereaved person wants a relationship to live, right? Where, you know, I want them to, you know, fully kind of put flesh on the bones of the dead person in a storied form when I'm talking with him, and then pick into those places that, that develop those stories of identity, both for the deceased person as well as for them and the dance that's going to be happening between them for the rest of their lives, the same philosophy, the same thinking informs the way in which I sit with people when they're dying, right? It's just the other side of the coin where I'm going to be asking about where is it, who else holds your stories, and where is it that those you would like those stories to have tentacles, right? Where do you hope that they will continue to grow, right? I might be asking people before they die about stories they want edited out of their versions, right? That it's not unusual.
It's probably a few I could use that.
Yeah. I mean, this happens where people say, you know, look, that story is, that part of my life was great. This part wasn't. Please don't speak about those kinds of things, you know, or speak about it with love when you do. So I could be speaking with people who are dying in the same kinds of ways about, you know, what we used to write about 20 years ago about talking about ethical wills, you know, which is kind of a tradition in Judaism that talks about, you know, how, what kinds of things you want people remembering about, what was important to you, that you can take, forward. The whole movement around ethical wills or, kind of living legacy kind of work, you know, or memories in a box kind of work, unfortunately has been, both taken up by capitalism, but also, you know, so you can get like really cute journals, you know, like stories about my grandmother, please write in before you die kind of thing. But it's also been a really individualistic process, which is unfortunate, right? So, you know, when you have that kind of ideas around, you know, living legacies or, you know, stories that you can fill in before somebody dies, has been a relational one. And so the kinds of things I'm interested in is really exploding that out further to say, who do you want to hold these stories? Right, and how is it we're going to take care of that? Right, you know what? When I've worked with people when they've been dying, and we have some time, that I'm really going to be mapping that with them. You know, what kinds of things do we want people knowing about you? Right, what would be important for you? And if they did know those things about you, or they did call on you, or did remember you at this time, in this way, what difference would that make for you? Knowing what it is that you have to do right now, right? there was a fellow that I talked with who was also really, really old, and he had outlived everybody in his family. And he was worried that when he died that he would be forgotten because he was kind of the last of his kid had died, his spouse had died, all of his friends had died, and he was like 103. And when I had some time when I was working with him, and it just through happenstance one day I was sitting with him, and I was sitting, he lived in this little board and care room, and I was sitting in his room chatting, and I was admiring, he had this beautiful artwork in this small little room where he lived, and I was asking him about these different pictures in his room, and he was telling me about, you know, where, when he and his wife had collected, you know, these different pieces of art, and that this had meant a lot to him, and when he moved into that facility, that he had carefully selected the art that he was going to take with, that the, each one had different memories connected to it. And so I was asking him what was going to happen to it when he died. And he said that he had made arrangements with a local art museum that he was going to donate this. You know, they were beautiful pieces of work and had some monetary value. And he wanted them to go to people who would appreciate them. And so I asked him if he would be okay with us actually writing the stories of the artwork. And if he would let me interview him about that. And so what we ended up doing was I interviewed him about each piece of art that was going to the museum, about where he acquired it, who he was with, what it meant to him, what he hoped people would notice about it when they were looking at it. And each one became like a couple-page document. And I contacted the museum and said, you know, we would like these pieces of art that you are going to be bequeathed to you to come with these stories. And so for this fellow, this meant the world to him, right? Because what we were doing in that process was that we were constructing a future audience that would come to know his life through these pieces of art, right?
Yeah.
Right? So remembering has lots of different ways in which we can creatively work, right? When we're looking at where does the relationship live, right? Relationships should always be plural, by the way. Mm-hmm. Where do they live, and where will they continue to be viable, right? Mm-hmm. And then I can always come back to that kind of indicative voice with this fellow, for example, and say, you know, what difference does it make for you that you know that people are going to be inspired by these stories when they look at this art?
Yeah.
Right? And does that make what you have to do? Does it shift what you have to do, right? Meaning die.
Yeah.
Right? Does that make your death easier to bear, knowing that you're not going to just be forgotten?
Right.
Right.
That's wonderful. Mm. Okay, final question. Thank you for all of that, by the way. But I
you're
have
welcome.
One more question, and
okay.
It's more off topic. It's just curiosity question about, you know, what are you reading, listening to, watching? What's catching your attention these days? What's,
oh my goodness.
What are you thinking about?
Oh,
I should have given you a heads up.
Jeezy
about that.
Geezy Pete, that's a really big question, Chris. Well, I've been reading a couple things. Because I'm on summer break right now, I've been reading a bunch of novels, which is always fun. Mm. And in my usual fashion, I never finish them. I have 10 going at once, and then
I feel you.
Yeah. But that's been really fun to just read some fiction. Before that, when I was actually reading and thinking about writing, I have become more fascinated with some ideas around queer theory as kind of the construction of failure. Mm-hmm. I was reading Jack Halvorsen's work.
And it's Queer Art of Failure.
Yeah.
Listeners.
Yeah. Queer Art
highly
of Failure.
Recommend.
Highly recommend that book. I was reading some Butler as well on gender construction. And kind of looking into some different domains on how we can continue to kind of queer death. Mm. Death in itself is queer, right? Because it's not normally what we think about. And narrative is queer because, you know, we're looking at things that are non-essentialized ideas. But looking at where some of those intersections can enhance some of the writing that I'm doing, some of the thinking that I'm doing, I've been kind of playing with some of those ideas.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. How can people find you if they want to? We were talking before we hit record about you updating a website.
I am updating my website. Yeah, it will be done probably this next month. It's still live, but it's just outdated.
And there's a ton of resources on it, actually. And
correct.
So,
correct. Some of those links are still working.
Your writing is up there.
A bunch of my writing is at the rememberingpractices.com website. Mm. That's kind of the best way. And people contact me through there as well. And that will be all shiny brand new and sparkly probably by October 1 is
great.
What I'm guessing.
And this podcast will be on there too.
Yeah, and this podcast can be there too.
Right.
Yeah.
So rememberingpractices.com.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lorraine, for
coming, Chris.
In studio even.
Thank you.
You drove down to the beach today.
Drove to the beach. I needed some cool air.
To hang out. And so thank you very much. And
you're welcome.
Let's go eat some dinner.
Deal. Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Okay, that's our show. Wasn't that great? So fortunate that I get to be mentored by and work with Dr. Lorraine Hedke. I'm learning all the time, and I just really am grateful for that and appreciate that. And so thanks, as always, for watching the show. I just want to say really quick, please, if you liked that as much as I did, go rate and review the show on iTunes. We really appreciate that happens. So that's what I understand how we get out in front of people. So if you get value out of this podcast and you think others would too, please go rate and review the show on iTunes if you could. And of course, come join us and be part of the community at our Instagram piece at The Radical Therapist. We're on Facebook. We have a Facebook page at The Radical Therapist. On Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And of course, have a website and an email, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Love hearing from people. I know people send some emails. I promise I'm going to get you some swag and some other stuff. and respond to your emails. So I always like getting those. So hang in there with me. It's going to get done. And then, yeah, as always, my name is Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been another episode of The Radical Therapist, and thanks for listening.